You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
J.R. Finch.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, Book 1 by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, Book 2 in the series. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat-in-the-chair, hand-on-keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. The Sam Darling Cozy Set of Six, a box set of the Sam Darling Mystery Series. You can't beat the deal on this huge box set of six complete cozy mystery books, 800 pages, all in one, for a low, low price. Follow Samantha Darling, her dog Clancy, and her beloved George through the first six books in Geraldine Dufresne's best-selling cozy mystery series. Between her big family of five siblings, her charming hometown of Quincy, and a sudden run of murders, Sam has her own work cut out for her. No one asked her to investigate, but that has never stopped her before. Includes book number one, Who Killed My Boss? Number two, Any Meat in That Soup? Number three, Can You Picture This? Number four, Will You Marry Me? Number five, Where is Henderson? And number six, Who's the Rogue? Read the entire series, with a new one coming out this fall. The Sam Darling Mystery Series by Geraldine Dufresne. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have J.R. Finch. He is one of the authors of The Darwin Strain and R.J. McCready novel. Guys, last year we had his co-author Bill Shutt on the show with us talking about the Himalaya Codex. Such a great conversation with Bill last year. JR is here to talk about their brand new book, starring again R.J. McCready, one of the best protagonists that I've seen in thriller fiction in quite a while. Welcome to the show, JR.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thanks for coming on, JR. I'm a big fan of the book, the new one, and what you guys are doing in general. Before we get in and start talking about the book, though, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, boy. I think that goes way back. I was always way back in grammar school. So I was always writing strange stories. I know one of my teachers had said that when she was new to the school, the principal had said, yeah, this kid's a little strange. Here's a story he wrote about time moving backwards.
So. Oh, I love it. Love it. Were you a big reader as a youngster?
Believe it or not, I had trouble reading. I was dyslexic, so it was an extra hurdle to climb over, and I think in a way it might have given me more of a love of words than I would have had if I didn't have that extra hurdle to climb over.
Well, you know, I was the same way. I am dyslexic. It's not something you grow out of typically, but you do.
Right, I still am. I mean, if you tell me to navigate somewhere, if it's not out in the middle of the ocean, if it's along streets, left, right, left, forget it. I'm lost.
Right, but you do learn strategies that help you through life. Do you remember if there was a time where it seemed to unlock for you, or that that words became more important? You know, that it begins with a lot of frustration, as every kid with dyslexia has. But do you remember a time where it seemed to you seemed to crack the code on it a bit?
Yeah, there was a specific moment. There were some difficult times through junior high, grammar school, junior high school, high school, but I was very fortunate in that I ran into some very good teachers. And of course, a teacher loves nothing more than a kid that has parents that have just one question: how can we help? And so these teachers who viewed it as a joint family teacher effort. And although reading was difficult for me, it was a matter of the kid loves science, the kid loves art, and all these other things. And even having special projects for me where I would have to go through some journals and so on and figure out how to build something. And that just let the love of the work on the kid's strengths and let the love of the work pull him through and the reading will come next. Then, when I was 18 in college, there was a professor who said, in a class I was very interested in, the A student in this class will take down every word I say and write it down. And I asked him if I could bring a tape recorder to class, and he said, sure. And when I would get back to my room, I would try to write down every part I had missed in the lecture, and then I started writing faster. And somehow, over about a six-month period, once it started coming through the ears, what I heard, and through the fingers, because what people said was also a bit mixed up to me. It wasn't just what I was reading, I was what they then called auditory dyslexic, and it seemed to clear itself up within about 6 months. That going through the fingers rather than through whatever other, you know, rooted by the brain through the fingers seemed to be the proper way of finding new wiring in my brain to understand what people said.
I love that. Yeah, it's we're all wired a little differently, and when you find those little tips or tricks, it can literally be life-changing.
Yeah, and we're talking back when I was in junior high school, where they kept trying to shuttle kids who weren't scoring so high on the reading test and so on, and shuttle us into the annex classrooms and so on. I had a guidance counselor who was saying he shouldn't be taking the math classes and the science classes, and the science teacher said, hey, look, when it comes to microbiology, I've taught him everything I know. I have to be introducing him to people at the Museum of Natural History. So let him take my science classes. He'll do well.
I love that. You mentioned that you were a kid who loved art and science, and that your teachers noticed that. Some people will think that those can be disparate interests, that science and art are two complete opposite ends of the spectrum. I don't think so, but how do you see the nexus of science and art and how they contribute to each other and how they each help us to understand the world around us?
Oh, I think it's all connected, and I know a number of astronomers, for example, and planetary geologists who paint what would Europa look like up really close? That's the moon of Jupiter that we now know there's volcanoes erupting water onto the surface. And especially in particle physics, you'll meet people who are also musicians. And going all the way back, even Einstein, he was once, there's a story at Princeton where he was trying to explain things to a class that wasn't quite getting it. And they said, no, you know, what's going on with these particles is this. And he took out his violin and started playing. Now, there was a guy who could have been a concert violinist. He was that good at it. So a lot of people are polymathic and move back and forth between fields. You'll find a number of them, including James Cameron. I've watched him get almost a PhD level of understanding within only less than 2 months on cephalopods, for example, and the cephalopod brain. While he was designing a new type of submersible to go to the deepest part of the ocean, and while making the Avatar film.
right. Well, speaking of James Cameron, he's had some pretty nice words to say about the work that you've been doing with Bill Shutt and the books that you've been putting out. That has to be a pretty great compliment.
Yeah. I first met him on actually what was an engineering project, which I thought was a bit odd, and I found out very quickly that this guy is sort of like Da Vinci walking around the world today, and sometimes he'll make a painting that moves and sings. And I was wondering, is Spielberg like that? Are the others like that? And I asked around people I knew at Warner Brothers, and they said, no, Jim's the only one. Well, there is another that, I mean, Hollywood will attract today's Da Vincis. And all over the world, films are attracting them. Del Toro is another that you can sit around and talk about magnetic railguns launching cargo into space very cheaply. And so I understand why he and Cameron are very good friends.
Right. If they would only let Del Toro make the films that he wants to make, and if the studios would stay out of his way, then the world we live in would be a better place.
Well, he'll get there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, JR, what brought you around to novel writing? Very few of us begin our careers as novelists, and there's usually life experiences have been collected along the way. What was the path to where you are now?
Well, some experiences out in the field. So, I mean, that's why these novels have reality checks at the end, and you find out that a lot of what you thought was fiction actually happened. Now, we haven't run into Yeti yet, but a lot of the other things, and I mean, you'll notice that microbiology is a kind of under theme of all these books, and I mean, basically, bacteria have taken over the world long ago. We just live in their world. So some of these ideas do come through in the novels. And there are certain microbes that have been discovered by accident that actually have had some strange effects that we cannot quite explain, where people on one group of expeditions, some of whom happened to be very ill from certain diseases that looked like they were just going to progress to a very bad end, and they ended up getting infected and having spontaneous remissions. So that's a whole area of research that's going on, but that made its way into, well, what if? And so, you know, if one's allowed to speculate on this subject, well, put it into a novel as fiction and just ask, what if? Hence the Darwin strain.
Right. And the what if questions are the best because they allow us to allow our imaginations to just go to the places that that challenge us, and you know, what story is a powerful thing in that it allows us to see the how the consequences of how things play out.
Yeah, and I mean, right now I can see these consequences playing on, and hopefully the publisher will want these to continue because I see the next two novels ahead of me.
So how did you and Bill get together, and what was the formation of the relationship that birthed these stories and these characters?
Knew him from way back, and you know, I had done as a student an internship at the American Museum of Natural History. He ended up working there, and we had known each other for quite a while. And while working on our other projects, we kind of started putting together notes, what ended up being about 800 pages of notes over almost a 10-year period for what became the novel Hell's Gate. And then one day I had about a 3-month period of time, and I looked at it and I said, might be time to take this, all these notes apart and put them into a novel. And he had an agent that he was doing his nonfiction with, and he brought that to her, and we figured, okay, you know, we might as well do something with all this stuff we've been working on all these years and put it into a novel. Figured it'd be a one, just get the novel out there. And the editor loved Hell's Gate and said, hey, you think you guys can do a 2-book deal? Thought about it for a few minutes and said, yeah, where do you want to go next? The Yeti mythos or the Kraken mythos? You know, in Hell's Gate, we had done the Chupacabra and not your grandmother's Chupacabra. And then in the Himalayan Codex, certainly that's not your grandmother's version of the Yeti mythos. And just pour lots of new wine into that old jug.
Right. I think all three of your published books now, Hell's Gate, the Himalayan Codex, and now the Darwin Strain, there's an element to each of these stories that I find fascinating in that World War II and the post-World War II era really plays into these books as a catalyst of sort. What is it about that time period and the way the world changed around that time that is a great launching pad for some of these stories?
Well, I've worked with a number of people in the field of forensic archaeology who, during the past 2 decades, we've been looking at things like what happened in Pompeii, what happened when the island of Thera blew up, which, you know, Thera is the old name for Santorini, where the action takes place in the Darwin strain. And also, forensic archaeology has finally moved into a lot of World War II sites. It started with places like Auschwitz and dealing with the people who were, you know, Holocaust denialists. And also during the last 2 decades in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the people I've been working with, and including one who was looking at the submarines that had been found off of Pearl Harbor, World War II really did become a theme. My father was, in fact, it turns out Bill's father and my father traveled in parallel from Normandy on through the Battle of Veer into the Bulge, and finally my father ended up one of the American POWs in Buchenwald. And after the movie Saving Private Ryan came out, and this was a period that my dad only told me some of the humorous things that happened, and after the movie came out, he took me to that movie and he said, just pay attention to the first 15 minutes. This is what we saw. I found out later he was at Omaha Beach, the 82nd Engineer Battalion, and he had a whole box full of maps, letters. I never knew he had traveled through much of the war with a camera, and he handed it to me, and he said, look, maybe you or the kids will want to write something about this. I think that's what kind of started keying me more and more into World War II. And then I started getting called on projects that had to deal with the atomic bombs and all of that. So it kind of naturally began to flow to that period. I mean, the world really changed coming out of World War II. And you had so much going on. If you look closely at the character that people love to hate, Nora Nesbitt, if you look closely, you'll see that everything she is doing, and if you read between the lines, especially in the end, you'll see that it's because she had a child who died. And now we'll get more in forthcoming stories about polio and how so many families knew the experience of a child doing. Everything she's doing is that no family, she's hoping no family will ever know the horror that she knew.
Right. I love it when you're able to weave those threads through this kind of meta story that's being told across all these books, and you see character motivations. It's so much fun. And as a storyteller, that has to be a great satisfaction to know that there's all these details that you're weaving in and know that there's more coming for readers.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, it's relevant today because we have the anti-vax people right. And everything. And, you know, in the next book where we look more at what polio was in this time period.
Oh, you know, and it brings up a great point that it's so, because of technological advances and the prices people before us paid, then we get crazy stuff like anti-vaxxers, because we've never seen those things. We don't appreciate the weight, that was the situation. And you know, that's the danger of kind of living in a peaceful, well society, is that we don't see the price that was paid.
Right. Up until the 1950s, it was very common for families to know the death of a child. And it was, you know, it happened in about half of families. And if you go even further back, before the drugs of the 1930s and 40s were developing, if you go back to, for example, reading the diaries of people who survived the sinking of the Titanic and the Lusitania and so on, you find that almost everyone knew the death of a father who died young, and sometimes from things like hitting his thumb with a hammer, and he got an infection and died. This happened in far more than half of families. If you go back to the period 1910 to 1915.
It's crazy. I remember there was an older man in my community when I was a kid who walked with canes and leg braces, and I remember my grandparents and some folks saying that that he was crippled by polio, you know, as a kid, and that's not something, you know, that we've seen in you know, 3 decades or so as those older folks have died off. It's just something that's not prevalent anymore.
Yeah, the engineer, explorer, writer, author C. Clarke. He had polio. He was born in 1917, and he had polio. And what we began seeing in the 1990s was those who had survived polio and had not been outright crippled by the disease were being crippled in their older age by what we now know as post-polio syndrome. But it's amazing that we have forgotten that period.
Right. Well, in your books, one thing that I find fascinating and that I would imagine is a challenge and probably an adventure in itself in telling these stories that you guys do that are so full of science and so full of discovery, but telling those stories through the lens of, you know, technology that's you know, many decades old. What are some of the challenges and some of the fun things about exploring a story that's so full of science and discovery, but using tools that were not available? These stories would be completely different if they were told present day. How about telling these in the 1940s?
Yeah, it's for instance, they're looking at what is kind of like genetic engineering, but in a way we had been doing that long before we really knew even what DNA was made of, even what it looked like. So we were doing things like modifying a virus so that it could become the polio vaccine. We were doing, as mentioned in the book, when they come across the Darwin strain, it's even though they do not know what DNA looks like at that time, it's just like with the atomic bombs. No one knew what a proton was made of, but we were like Neanderthals playing with napalm. That the technology for applying something and using it for either good or bad comes ahead of your really understanding what's happening with what you're doing. I mean, surely when people were burning each other's villages, they did not know about oxidation and oxygen and carbon and how fire worked, but they were able to use fire. And it's the same thing back in the 40s and the 50s, and it's the same thing today.
In the series of books, you take some legends and stories that have been passed down sometimes thousands of years and look at the plausibility of those and bring them into a reality where these things could happen. What do you think about the existence of legends that have survived and permeated cultures? Where do you think some of these things come from?
Yeah, I do kind of wonder where Pliny got some of the stories he was describing. And he had described some animals that people had thought were too fantastical to be real. And then, of course, we find out, well, the gorilla actually does exist. And I've always been mystified by his description of what he called the polypus and what we call today an octopus. And what if that animal was real? What if something like that really existed? And there are many descriptions of similar animals, so they make their way into the Darwin strain. And then it's where, and you'll see all the books are connected. So in the Darwin strain, you finally learn the origin of the creatures that Pliny described and the Cirrhae, as they were called, which were something that lived in the direction of the Himalayas, in the valleys, and it was somewhere between human and something not human, but they were very intelligent and able to build a civilization. And you wonder, is this something he described from locals during his travels or story that was passed like a game of telephone from the Himalayas all the way to Rome. So in the Himalayan Codex, it became, well, what if he was describing something real? And then where would that come from? Well, you get the answer to that in the Darwin strain.
Right. In the Darwin strain, we see that that there's a fountain that is exhibiting healing properties, and you know, as things happen, people start laying claim to that and taking credit for, or you know, other people think that it's evil, and you get these kind of new legends that are born around these things. What is research like for these books, and do you find places where these anomalies are happening and try to does that play into the what if scenario of these books? Like, what do you do to start looking for where these things might be happening around the world?
Well, we have happened upon things that are somewhat similar, although it's magnified in the novel, that have left us puzzled and that have led to that what if. And if the people who had spontaneous remissions, was this coincidence? Is it only anecdotal? But what if? I mean, in one case, we did find a new form of penicillin that had infected people. And unfortunately, it's very uncooperative in the lab. It does not behave the same way twice. And of course, that comes through in the novel. You know, we see where going back through, where we see glimpses of people who had tried to use the Darwin strain and where sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And so a lot in the novel is based on, you know, being creatively speculative about, well, what if? And what if you had a Fatima-like situation that became very widely known, and it could be either destructive or evil, and everyone wants to get in there and find out what it is and how it can be used. And then you have these ancient biblical references, and you also have the hidden texts, things like the Nag Hammadi library that was found in Egypt within the time frame of these novels. And for instance, there are 4 apocalyptic books. And so the things from those books that are quoted in the novel, those are from text that actually do exist.
Oh, wow. And I don't want to give away too much about the book, but you know, we go from a magic spring, if you will, with religious overtones, to the dragons of Revelation and Krakens, and in such a subtle and logical path through all these things, and it's so well done. How do you guys break up writing responsibilities, and what is your, when you've got two writers, what is your brainstorming and outlining process like?
It depends mostly who has more free time at any given, during any given year. And so we go back and forth a bit. On the third book, we went back and forth a little bit. Bill's schedule was very intense at the time, so I kind of ended up taking over there. You know, Darwin, the first book, Hell's Gate, we went back and forth for a couple of years on that. And we ended up with 800 pages for a while. So we end up working it out.
Yeah. Have you discovered any tools that help in your process with sharing manuscript or notes back and forth? Is there any... anything that you guys have settled on that that is invaluable to your process?
Try to keep a sense of humor.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
That would be my number one piece of advice.
That's fantastic. JR, I absolutely love the books. I love the characters and what you guys are doing. I'm so looking forward to more books coming up. Have you guys nailed down a fourth book, or is there going to be a new one in the series?
I'd love to. I have a pretty solid outline for where this will go up to an end point. I definitely see a book four and a book five, and I know exactly what they will be about. Book four is kind of laid down in book three, and the editor seems to want it because she helped me lay that out in order to pave the way for book four. So pretty sure we'll be getting there.
Nice. Well, the new book is called The Darwin Strain. It's available everywhere now in hardback and audiobook in Kindle edition. I listened to the audio.
One more fun thing that people might want to look at, because I know people now, when they read and the name of someone comes up, they go right to their smartphones. So this book has a little sub-stories woven through it that if you look up the names of certain people and you look up certain places, you'll find connections to a whole sub-story beneath the story.
Dang it,
so you'll find out who that guy Sparks Rubenstein is and how he's connected to others in the story.
Oh, well, that's the sound of everyone's smartphones right now.
Yeah.
Oh, so much fun. Now, dang it, I've got to go back and reread it. And the audio of the first two books is fantastic, and I'm about to get the audio of book three. I have the hardcover, but I'm going to get the audio because it was so much fun listening to those as well as reading. JR, if people want to know more about you and Bill, is there a place online where they can kind of dig into all that you do?
Well, I know Bill has a website. I basically just I'm a bit reclusive, so.
Excellent. Well, we'll link up your Amazon page and the publisher page, and we'll send everyone to pick up their copy of the book. JR, it's been so much fun talking. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
He led Jason to a small bistro. The door set tiny bells to chime as they entered. The place shivered with smells. Coffee, hot chocolate, and croissants. "This," he said, extending his arm towards a woman in an apron, "is Jennifer. She makes the best scones and is tragically spoken for." He kissed the woman's hand. She was plump, in her 50s. She had left one curler to dangle at the back of her head this morning.
"If it's a tragedy to you, this is the first I've heard of it." She swatted at him with a menu. "Why didn't you speak up 20 years ago, lady killer?"
Jason sat. Jennifer put a glass of water in front of him.
"And who is this fine gentleman?"
"This," said Hedwick, joining, "is my son's great-grandfather's great-great-nephew."
"That's a lot of greats. Any great-great-great-whatever of Hedwick is great by me."
She giggled at her own wit.
"I'll be back for your orders."
Hedwick swatted her rear end with a menu as she left. He made small talk about the bistro, the specials, what was good, the Benedict, or not so, the hanger steak. When their orders came, coffee for both, eggs for Jason, a scone for himself, he got down to business.
"I met your grandmother about, a year ago. Valerie and I have a mutual interest in old families, particularly old families related to the legend, for obvious reasons. Valerie's lived in Tarrytown for years, though her family's up near Boston. Now, don't worry. I don't believe all that nonsense about a headless horseman. Valerie's the superstitious one. But the Van Brunts are definitely the family in Irving's story. Hermanus Van Brunt and his wife Agatha were farmers in the village back in 1780 or so. This was during the Revolution. Hermanus grabbed title to lands left by a Tory family who'd been tarred and feathered and shipped back to Britain. Do you know your history?"
"Sure. Tory. Loyal to the king. Benjamin Franklin broke with his own son, who was a Tory."
"Smart boy. Traitors to the cause. And that was serious business. The British marched straight through here during the war, chased George Washington off Manhattan and out to New Jersey. And after they were kicked out again, a lot of Tories were kicked out with them. Anyway, the Van Brunts took over some farmland north of Tarrytown. They had a son, Abraham. And, of course, their son Abraham married a wealthy heiress. Katrina Van Tassel. Yes, all that is true. It's public record, just like the legend says. My mother left behind quite a few documents written by Abraham Van Brunt, Brahm, in Dutch, mostly. He was powerful around here. With Katrina's money, he became the biggest stone merchant in the state. He died in 1850. After him, it's Dylan Van Brunt, his son, Joseph, the grandson, then Cornelius, then... Sorry, genealogy is not my thing. No? Why was Eliza doing research on the Van Brunts? She wasn't. She was looking into the Cranes. That's what made us such fast friends. I don't get it. We do go back a ways, your family and mine.
More coffee? Jennifer appeared at Jason's elbow.
Hedwig nodded and she poured.
Still not getting it, said Jason.
But he did. Hedwig turned to the waitress, and Jason knew what he would say. My lady, may I present? He raised his coffee cup, proclaiming, the last descendant of Ichabod Crane.